Welcome to Torah Timachanach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Sarah Malka Winter, and today we will be learning Melachim Beis, Perek Ches, Chapter 8. Perek Ches is a series of stories that will take us all around Eretz Yisrael to both of the kingdoms, Yehuda and Yisrael, and even to Aram. In the first story of this Perek, Psukim Aleph Tevav, we meet an old friend, one we are happy to meet, the Isha Shunamis. The beginning of this parak takes us back 7 years, all the way to the beginning of the famine that has finally ended. Elisha, who had already given her a child and brought him back to life in Parak Dalet, chapter 4, now saves them from the famine, warning them of its arrival and instructing her to leave Eretz Yisrael for its duration. Elisha diber le'isha asher hachaya espina le'mar, kumi ulechi at uveisech v'guri ba'asher toguri, ki kara Hashem l'ra v'gam ba'al ha'aretz sheva shanim. In verse 1, Elisha spoke to the woman who he had revived her son, saying, "Get up, go, you and your house, and live wherever you want, because Hashem has called this famine, and it will come on this land for 7 years." And in verse 2, Vatakam ha'isha vatas kedvar isha lokim, this woman got up and she did like the isha lokim said, Vatelechi uvesa, and she and her house went, Vatagar pe'eretz plishtim, sheva shanim, and she lived in the plishtim for 7 years. Rashi notes that the pasuk stresses that she only left because Elisha told her to. This is not something she would have done on her own, to leave the Jewish nation during a famine in their time of need. We have learned this from the family of Elimelech and Naomi, and we know that the Isha Shunamis is a woman who invests in community. She is a giver, would not choose this on her own. Verse 3 takes us to the end of the 7 years. The Isha Shunamis returns to find that her house and her property have been taken over by thieves. She goes to the king to protest and try to get her land back. And who is there talking with the king? Gehazi. Why? Verse 4. V'hamelech medaber al Gehazi nar ish ha'lokim leimar, saprana li es kol hagdolos asher asa Elisha. The king was talking to Gehazi, the lad of the man of God, saying, "Please tell me all the miracles that Elisha has done." There is a very important message in the story. Sometimes we think, if we would only see miracles, if we would only get to really experience and see for ourselves a true demonstration of Hashem running the world, then of course we would be great people. If we could have seen what Naaman saw, for example, we would also be transformed. Here in chapter 8, we are reminded of Gehazi, someone who has seen more than anyone else, someone who was known by the king as the national expert on miracles. And he is so flawed, and he misses opportunity after opportunity for growth. And we are faced with the truth that we really know nothing changes if nothing changes. Experiences will only be transformative if we let them in. Only we can make ourselves great. And he chooses, of all stories, to tell the story of how Elisha revived the son of the Isha Shunamis. And who does he see peeking in through the window? The Isha Shunamis herself. Vayomer Gehazi, in verse 5, Adoni HaMelech, Zos HaIsha V'ze Bina Asher HaChaya Elisha. Gehazi said, "My master the king, this is the woman and this is her son that Elisha revived." The Medrash Yalkut Shimoni tells us, had she been in the other end of the world, Hashem would have flown her here. Why? Because Hashem doesn't want Rishaim telling over his miracles. Hashem's miracles are not cool stories. It's not story time. There is a lesson in each miracle. Hashem is talking to Bnei Yisrael. He's calling them home. He's showing himself to them. But to Gehazi, it's just a story, not a necessary impetus for change. And Hashem says, "Sorry, you may not tell my miracles." So the king asks the Isha Shunamis all the details of her story, and then, of course, what she was doing there, and he sent an officer to restore all of her property. Verses 7 to 15 bring us to Aram. Elisha is in Damascus, the capital of Aram. Radak, quoting Chazal, tells us so poignantly that what brought Elisha to Aram was his wayward student, Gehazi, who had left Eretz Yisrael and left Am Yisrael. He had done something no one living in that time would have done. He left Judaism and joined the Arami nation. And Elisha went to Damascus to try to talk to him, to try to bring him home. But Gehazi refused, declaring that he had passed the point of no return, that he would not be able to do teshuva anymore. In verse 7, Elisha arrives in Damascus, and the king of Aram, Ben-Hadad, was sick. and finds out that Elisha is here. And so in verse 8, the king tells Hazael, his servant, take a present and go greet the Navi and find out from him, from God, if I will live from this illness. And that is what Hazael does. In verse 9, Hazael goes to meet Elisha with a gift, and he stands before him and he asks, will Ben-Hadad live from this illness? In verse 10, Elisha says to him, Lech emar lo lo chayo techyeh, v'her'ani Hashem ki mos yamus. Elisha says to him, go tell him that he will surely live, but Hashem has shown me that he will surely die. Either, as Mitsudos explains, as medical science has caught on to more recently, there is a direct relationship between our psychological and our physical health. Telling a critically ill patient that he is going to die would actually kill him. So I'm telling you the truth, but this is not something you need to tell him. Or, as Malbim explained, it's not really such a simple answer, because the king of Aram will not actually die from the illness, but he will die. So he will live and he will die. And then Elisha behaves very unexpectedly. He turns his face to the wall and tries to hide his tears and emotions from Hazael. And then when he can no longer do this, he begins to cry. And in verse 12, a mystified Hazael asks, why is my master crying? And Elisha responds, because I know the bad, the evil that you will do to the Jewish people. You will set their fortresses on fire. You will slaughter their youth, and you will crush their infants, and you will break their pregnant women. What is going on here? So we may recall back in Malachim Aleph, Eliyahu HaNavi was told to anoint three people, Elisha as a Navi, Yehu as the king of Yisrael, and Hazael as the king of Aram. All of these three will act as punishing agents for Malchus Yisrael, who had sinned so terribly against Hashem. As we learned then, the only one that Eliyahu actually did was making Elisha the new Navi after him. The other two will be taken care of by Elisha himself, Hazael in this chapter and Yehu in the next. And Elisha knows he needs to do this, but as a Navi who loves Bnei Yisrael so much, he can't help but cry bitterly as he informs Hazael of the terrible and cruel atrocities he will commit on babies and pregnant women. When women and infants are targeted, it demonstrates a level of cruelty and hatred that is unparalleled, and Elisha cannot help but cry. Or perhaps he is using the opportunity to cry to Hashem because the gates of tears are never locked, and even now as he is literally appointing Hazael and informing him of these acts, Elisha does not stop davening. We understand so much about the depraved nature of Hazael from his reaction, as these words of Elisha that should have provoked horror and disgust for Hazael is just a sign of power. Verse 13, Vayomer Hazael, ki ma avtecha hakelev, ki yaaseh hadavar hagadol hazeh. Hazael says, what? Your servant is a dog. How will I be able to do this great thing? Vayomer Elisha, and Elisha needs to admit, Her'ani Hashem oscha melech al Aram. Hashem has shown me that you will be the king of Aram. Verses 14 and 15 describe how Hazael then assassinates the sick king Ben-Hadad with a wet pillow, seemingly murder by hypothermia, and he becomes the next king. And now in story 3, our chapter takes us to the kingdom of Yehuda, whom we really have not focused on since chapter 3 in that joint war against Moab. And get ready for some more confusing years. And to make it even more confusing, both kings of Yisrael and Yehuda have the same name, Yehoram. So verse 16. Uvishnas chamesh li Yoram ben Achav melech Yisrael v'Yehoshaphat melech Yehuda malach Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat melech Yehuda. This pasuk is hard to read. I'm going to try to translate it two different ways, both according to Mitzudas David. In the fifth year of Yehoram ben Achav, the king of Yisrael, Yehoshaphat, the king of Yehuda, crowned his son Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat king over Yehuda. Or, in the fifth year of Yehoram ben Achav melech Yisrael and the fifth year of Yehoshaphat melech Yehuda, that's when Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat melech Yehuda became king. But how can this second way be true? How can this be the fifth year of Yehoshaphat? Didn't Yehoshaphat rule for 25 years? Will his son take over after only five? This brings back the seven new years of life that Yehoshaphat received after doing Teshuvah in Ramos Gilead. This is year five of the new count, which is really his 23rd year. And Chazal explained to us that Yehoshaphat crowned his oldest son Yehoram 2 years before Yehoshaphat died, meaning for those final 2 years of Yehoshaphat's life, they shared the throne. In verse 17, it tells us that Yehoram was 32 years old when he became king and ruled for 8 years in Yerushalayim. We don't know so much about Yehoram from our chapter, only that his wife was the daughter of Ahav, that evil Ataliah, so similar to her mother Izebel in her murderous and idolatrous ways, and that he followed in the ways of that evil family, rather than learning from his righteous father, Yehoshaphat. This is a terrible new situation. A Yehuda king who behaves like a Yisrael king. A Yehuda king who, as we find out in the more detailed Divrei Hayamim version of this story, causes Yehuda to turn away from Hashem, encourages them to serve idols. A Yehuda king, again told to us in Divrei Hayamim, who will murder all of his brothers whom he sees as rivals. And in our verse 19, it says, Hashem did not want to destroy Yehuda for David, his servant. Kasher amar lo lasis lo nir levanav kol hayamim, as Hashem had told him that he would leave a candle for his children all of the days. And with this introduction, we are told of a crisis that he experienced. Edom, who had been a kind of a colony of Yehuda since the days of David, rebels and actually crowns their own king. This should have been a major wake-up call for Yehoram. Chazal teach us that as the prophecy told to Rivka Imenu stated, Milo'om Yelo'om Ye'emat, one will be stronger than the other. The two nations of Yaakov and Esau will always be like a seesaw. When one is up, the other is down. There are eight kings from Esau listed in Sefer Bereishis, all who ruled before we had our first king, and then in the days of David, Edom, the nation of Esau, was conquered. And counting David, Ishbosheth, Shlomo, Rechavam, Aviam, Asa, Yehoshaphat, and now Yehoram, there have now been eight kings of Yehuda. Edom rebelling was not just a political situation, it was a clear sign from Hashem. But Yehoram's response is to take his army at night to Tzair and conquer what he could. Was this a powerful victory or not? According to Malbim, it was the opposite. Here was Yehoram, the sovereign nation, trying to make an impression on these rebels, and he attacks them at night. Only the surrounding chariots, and then immediately retreats. The message Edom heard from this was weakness and fear. Radak sees this battle as a powerful surprise attack, and were it not the plan of Hashem, should have made a deep impression on Edom. But however we evaluate this battle, the result was the same. In verse 22, it tells us that Edom rebelled completely from under the hand of Yehuda until today, and then also, Livna rebelled at that time. Who was Livna? According to Rashi, this was a Jewish city who was so disgusted and disillusioned at this time that they themselves rebelled and seceded from Yehuda. Verses 23 and 24 close the era of Yehoram. 8 years of failure and disappointment and dead at 40. Again, Divrei Hayamim in chapter 21 fills in the blanks with fascinating details. There was a letter sent from Eliyahu Hanavi crying out to Yehoram about the murderous, idolatrous choices he had made and informing him that he will be punished for all of that. His wives and children will be taken by Plishtim and he will die of terribly painful illness. And by the time he died, his body was so wasted that he was not in fact buried with the rest of the kings of Yehuda. Story number 4 begins with the crowning of the last remaining son of Yehoram, whose name is Ahaziah. He begins his rule in the 12th year of his uncle Yehoram Melech Yisrael, and he will rule for only 1 year. His mother is Ataliah. In verse 26, it says that he is 22 years old when he becomes king. In Divrei Hayamim, it actually gives his age at 42. But Chazal reminds us that that isn't even possible. He became king the year his father died at 40. How could he be 42? And Chazal explained, if you want to understand the story of Ahaziah, his story truly begins 42 years ago. Ataliah is not the first time a king from Yehuda married someone from the family of Ahav actually, the Tzaddik Yehoshaphat himself actually had married the daughter of Omri, the sister of Ahav, and that was the beginning of this mixed family and also the beginning of the devastation of the house of David. Verses 25 through 27 talk about how Ahaziah as well followed in the path of the house of Ahav, influenced by his mother Ataliah. And as this chapter kind of goes full circle, he joined his uncle Yehoram, Melech Yisrael, in a war against Hazael, the king of Aram. The war took place in Ramoth-Gilead, that city in the Nahalah of Gad, originally a city of Levium, taken over by Aram, where Ahav lost his life. Now Ahav's son Yehoram is trying to get it back and fights Hazael, the new king of Aram. And in the middle of this battle, in verse 29, Yehoram gets wounded and goes to Yisrael to convalesce. And his nephew Ahaziah, the king of Yehuda, goes to visit him. And so with both armies now leaderless in Ramoth-Gilead and both kings far from the battlefield, we certainly have a feeling that things are coming to a head. And the name Yisrael, does that ring a bell? We will recall next parak what Yisrael means to the family of Ahav and why what happens next in Yisrael is true justice. Taking a look back now at our parak, let's try to process. Something huge and catastrophic has happened, but we could miss it if we are not paying enough attention. By now, we may have become a little numb to the failures of Malchus Yisrael, the northern kingdom. Their avodah zarah, their power, their greed, their distance from Hashem, the lack of moral clarity or pursuit of good and justice, we have gotten used to it. Reading their crimes no longer sends shockwaves. We have stopped expecting anything more from them. But Yehuda? This is the family of David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech. At least they remain loyal to Hashem, to the Beit HaMikdash, to his Nevi'im, to the Torah. But in this chapter, we lose even this. Yehoram and Ahaziah serve Avodah Zarah. Yehoram kills his own brothers, and the boundaries between the two kingdoms have all but disappeared. Ataliah, the daughter of Ahav, the wife of Yehoram Melech Yehuda, the mother of the next king Ahaziah, is evil. And even though Yehoshaphat is alive at the beginning of this new era, it is Ataliah who is the real force behind the throne. The language used in verse 19 is tragic. Hashem has promised not to destroy Yehuda, as he promised David to give him a light for his children all the days. But what happens when the children of David begin to self-destruct? What happens if they willingly stamp out their own light, their own Ner? This parak seems to be just a random stories of political challenges and military exercises, but hiding behind all these stories is a dark and tragic truth, a turning point. Yehuda has joined forces with Yisrael, and the ramifications are going to be catastrophic. Thank you for studying together Li'iloi Nishmot Imahotenu Hayikarot, Esther Oppenheimer Alaha HaShalom, and Sarah Schenker Alaha HaShalom, each deeply devoted and proud to transmit their family's Torah legacy to the next generations.